my feet burnt in sand. No hope for a lost young man. He was carried away, carried away.
This is The Two Sons of Tatooine, a Star Wars prequel trilogy fanfic written by Chronic Bookworm and read by Rena Jenkins. The story is rated PG-13 and is Jen, with additional tags for background Padme Amidala Anakin Skywalker, alternate universe canon divergence, family, families of choice, friendship, slavery, Tatooine slave culture, slave trade, slave revolts, slave revolution, unfettered Anakin. Shmi adopts Obi-Wan. Anakin and Obi-Wan raised as brothers. Fix it, of sorts. Anakin as a space pirate freedom fighter. Obi-Wan as a revolutionary coordinator. Shmi as the leader of the revolution. No women were fridged in the making of this fic. The Jedi Order is problematic. Qui-Gon Jinn is problematic. Qui-Gon Jinn means well. Jedi Master Dooku. Implied referenced torture. Loss of limbs. Electrocution. Brief mentions of forced prostitution. Mentions of physical abuse. Author's notes. The story deals with themes of slavery, trauma, loss of agency, and the reclaiming thereof. I don't think anything is exceptionally graphic, but if you need further content details and warnings, please don't hesitate to contact me, and I will happily provide more details and answer any questions. Also, please don't hesitate to let me know if you think of any tags that should be added. I play loose and fast with the EU, keeping the bits that suit me and discarding the rest. Canon has received a similar treatment. This borrows heavily from Tatooine slave culture headcanons created by the amazing Fjallaril. The Amvika people, the Amataka language, including the words Dapur, Dapuran, Nimdara, and Zai, Ekreth, Akar-Hinil, Leia the Elder Sister, the Unfettered, and the symbol of the Unfettered, Amavikan marriage rituals, the idea of the slaves of Tatooine being in part descended from the Sand People, and anything else you recognize from Tatooine slave culture are all theirs. The premise and large parts of the plot for Anakin's arc, as well as parts of Shmi's arc and the way the slave revolution takes place, are taken specifically from the Fires of the Outer Rimverse and the Space Pirates verse. Don't forget to check out Payne's Gray's amazing art. Links will be provided in the metadata of this podfic. Summary. Rejected by the Jedi Order at the age of 13, Obi-Wan Kenobi's ship is taken over by pirates, and he is sold as a slave on Tatooine and adopted by Shmi Skywalker. Elsewhere in the galaxy, clones are being created and a war is brewing, but the Skywalker family have their own concerns. The rising storm that is the slave revolution.
I catch you breathe so soft. Her lips are singing when they take me off. I heard a noise far away from above. I'm on my knees when the sun comes up.
Chapter 1. You have heard this story before. A young initiate full of anger. A Jedi Master who turns him down. A journey to Bandamir. Obi-Wan Kenobi is rejected by Qui-Gon Jinn as an apprentice, due to the anger in his heart. Reaching the upper age limit for a Jedi initiate, he is sent to join the Agra Corps on Bandamir, ending his chances of becoming a Jedi Knight. In another story, Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon Jinn meet again on Bandamir, where Obi-Wan impresses Qui-Gon, who finally takes him on as his Padawan. But that is not this story. This is a new story. In this story, Obi-Wan's ship never reaches Bandamir. It's taken over by pirates, most of the crew killed. Those who are not are taken to Tatooine and sold as slaves. Shmi Skywalker, always full of heart, takes one look at this lost, scared, angry young boy and adopts him as her own son. She lets him cry himself to sleep in her lap his first night in Gardula the Hutt's palace. Then she dries his tears and tells him gently not to waste water. In another life, Obi-Wan Kenobi lives his life by the strict Jedi Code. But the strict, dispassionate, unattached Jedi Code does not do well in the rough sands of Tatooine. The slaves of Tatooine form close bonds by necessity, and they welcome him as one of their own. He becomes attached to Shmi, his mother, and later to Anakin, his brother, to the grandmothers of Mos Espa, to the Twi'lek dancers, to the manual workers who come into the kitchen bone-weary, to the house slaves who feed them, to the children born into slavery, to the adults who raise them, to those like him who were kidnapped and sold later in life. He learns Amataka, the secret language of the slaves, the secret of Zai. He learns to make it according to Shmi's secret recipe, and compares it to that of other slaves who guard their recipe as closely as he guards Shmi's. Shmi's is best. He learns the stories of Aramu, the mother, of Ekreth, the trickster who frees himself and all slaves with him, of Akar Hinil, the celebrated pirate who plagued slave traders and who disappeared without a trace, and of Leia, the Mighty One, the elder sister, the great dragon who is unfettered. Obi-Wan Kenobi has always had a sharp mind. Here it is honed to secrets and trickery. He learns to keep his face blank and his tongue still. He learns to say one thing and mean another. He learns to subtly nudge people without saying a single word. Obi-Wan Kenobi in this life is not just a negotiator, but also a manipulator. The slaves call themselves Amavikan, children of the mother. Their religion is conveyed through stories. Obi-Wan has always believed that the Jedi have no religion. That is what they themselves say. The Jedi serve the Force, but that is different from the superstitious beliefs of backwater planets. At first, he listens to the stories as stories, meant to teach hidden wisdoms and transmit culture, but nothing more than myths and legends. After all, the Force is demonstrably there. It can be reached for. It allows him to lift things at a distance and gives him dreams of what will happen. But the Force is often mysterious, hard to reach, and behaves in similar ways to the mythological Aramu of the Amavikan. He finds that the stories he dismisses as mere stories hold both wisdom and truth. He does not abandon the Jedi Code. It has been with him for 12 years. It is ingrained into him. There is no emotion. There is peace, he tells himself, when all he wants to do is curl up into a ball and cry because he's hungry, his skin is red and blistered from the sun, and his back aches from when the overseer droid didn't think he was working fast enough. He hasn't had anything to drink today, and his feet are swollen from being on them all day. There is no ignorance, there is knowledge, he focuses on when he makes mistakes. When he doesn't know how to fit in this new life. When he wonders what his friends are doing if they think him dead, if anyone's looking for him. There is no passion. There is serenity. He whispers. When he feels his hatred of Gardula the Hutt, his master, his Dippur, almost overwhelms him. There is no chaos. There is harmony. He thinks, when Gardula decides it would be amusing to see the slaves fight over their meager rations, and he has to make sure Shmi eats, has to make sure something is kept for the children, for the grandmothers, grandfathers, and grandparents. When he watches Gardula open up her pleasure gardens, full of poisonous plants and predatory animals, and sends a bunch of slaves in, delighting in their gruesome end. There is no death. There is the Force, he murmurs, as he performs the Amavikan mourning rites for yet another friend who has been sold or killed. He misses them with the same intensity he misses Bant, Garen, and Quinlan from the temple, who are equally dead to him. When he first hears of the Amavikan mourning rituals, he holds one for everyone he knew from the temple, naming each of them and their relation to him. He doesn't cry. He's learned that much already. He wonders if they ever think of him. He wonders if they miss him as much as he misses them. Reciting the Jedi Code keeps him from feeling adrift, helps him accept his changed circumstances. He releases his feelings into the Force, allowing him to keep his face still and not betraying anything of his inner thoughts as he bows low to Gardula and calls her Master. And that word means something new and different to him. Not a mark of respect, but of ownership, of resentment. But he also prays to Aramu, or Leia, or Ekrath. And sometimes he feels like they listen more. In another story, Obi-Wan Kenobi lived on Tatooine for almost 2 decades and never knew or even suspected that there was a whole secret culture hidden there. In another story, Anakin Skywalker suppressed that side of his heritage completely when he became a Jedi and never confided in his master. Anakin knew the difference between slave master and mentor master. He also knew the difference was less than one might think. In Amataka, the word for master is Dapur, Dapuran in plural, meaning the one who binds in chains. The Amataka word for master leaves no room for ambiguity. Obi-Wan spends his first year of slavery convincing himself that the Jedi will come looking for him. His second year, hoping that they will stumble across him. His third, proclaiming to everyone that the Jedi aren't that great anyway. Obi-Wan Kenobi believed wholeheartedly in the Jedi Order. It hurts when that faith isn't reciprocated. He picks up the nickname Ben from a young child who can't pronounce Obi-Wan. Normally, most people who are enslaved later in life choose to keep their names in an attempt to preserve as much of their old identity as they can. Obi-Wan, however, was cast off, rejected from his old culture, and needs to rebuild his identity, having identified as Jedi Initiate for all his life. He finds it as one of the Amavikan. He never makes a choice to put away the last name Kenobi, but when people call him Skywalker, he doesn't correct them. Names are important. Kenobi is where he came from. Skywalker is where he belongs. Shmi goes out in the desert to trade with some Jawas, and she returns with a child growing inside her. The grandmothers cluck wisely and say she carries a storm inside her. A child born to no father but gifted by Aramu will bring the rain, it is said. It is understood that the rain means freedom. Others do not believe her. They know what the most likely story is when an unattached slave becomes pregnant and claims there is no father. Aramu or the Force, Ben doesn't know. But he believes utterly in his miracle brother, born as a child of the desert itself. Child-rearing is a communal activity among the slaves of Tatooine. If the parents are sold, the child will hopefully still have trusted adults nearby who can fill the hole in their heart. It doesn't help if the child is sold, of course. The slaves of Tatooine know that families are fleeting. They live with the constant risk of unwilling separation. They cling all the harder while they still have each other, and are always willing to expand their families and adopt new family members. Annie has not only Shmi and Ben, but also Jira and the other market sellers, and the cooks, cleaners, mechanics, and gardeners of Gardula's household looking out for him. Similarly, Annie's friends Kister, Melly, Amy, Wald, and Seek find comfort in Shmi's lap, or by Ben's side, just as Annie does. Annie is a fussy baby who grows into an obstinate child. Never a good trait for a slave. Ben walks him back and forth during the night to give Shmi a few precious hours of sleep. He is there when Anakin takes his first step and when he says his first word. He is there when Gardula has him beaten for being bothersome and when he repairs his first droid, the Force singing with joy. Annie is strong in the Force. Things he wants fly closer to him. His emotions bleed into the Force and onto others nearby. Ben is terrified that Gardula will find out and sell him to people who want Force-sensitive younglings for dark purposes. He has kept his own Force skills secret, but Annie's are stronger and he has less control. He sends as much calm energy as he can in Annie's direction, and as soon as he is old enough to sit still, they start meditating before bedtime. When he first came to Tatooine, he thought the grandmothers, the wisest of them all, and the leaders of the community must be Force-sensitive. He knows now what a short-sighted and ultimately insulting belief that is. There is much wisdom that is not of the Force, and Force-sensitivity is just one skill among many. It does not help him balance Gardula's finances, or make one day of rations stretch into three, or comfort a child who is hungry and hurting. Unless the child is Annie, who picks up on his emotions like a sponge. Ben finds he has never been so good at releasing his feelings into the Force as he is now, when any hint of stress or upset will spread to his brother and be magnified. He cobbles together a philosophy of the best parts of the Jedi Code with the best wisdom of the grandmothers, and imparts this philosophy to Annie. He leads him in Jedi meditations and Amavikan prayers, in weaponless katas of the Jedi Order, and acrobatic dances of Tatooine slaves. Nimdara, it's called. The dance so much like fighting that one style blends into the other, and he's not sure what is dance and what is sparring. The first time he saw slaves perform it at a celebration, he wasn't sure if it was choreographed or if they were using the Force to read each other. He now knows it is possible to be that much in sync with someone completely without the Force, just by knowing them and reading the cues in their body language. And eventually, they spar with discarded antennae, with sticks, with pieces of broken furniture and anything else they can pick up that vaguely resembles a lightsaber. It's nothing like wielding a lightsaber. It's close enough. Some things are universal. Obi-Wan Kenobi is Anakin Skywalker's teacher and mentor. They are brothers. Ben knows how to read and write Ord Bash, and he quickly picks up Huttese and Amataka, but they don't speak of that in public. He's always had an ear for language. And where in another life he picked up several through traveling the galaxy with Qui-Gon Jinn, in this life, he learns from the family droid, lovingly put together by himself and Annie. C-3PO knows 160 languages, at the state they were spoken 80 to 100 years ago. Ben, in this life, sounds very old-fashioned and archaic when he speaks Bocce. He learns the language very systematically and logically, in alphabetical order. He later convinces 3PO that that's not how humans learn. The droid finds it very confusing, which leads to a long discussion on the differences between droids and organics that the entire family gets involved in. Learning languages takes a lot of time in this life. Being literate and reasonably well-educated makes him valuable to Gardula. He is given more and greater responsibilities as a bookkeeper and logistician of her sprawling criminal empire. She starts to bring him along on her negotiations and deals, first as a secretary and notekeeper, then as a negotiator. He rises to prominence in her household, and he stands at her left shoulder. This is not a good thing. Slaves are safest when they are unknown, unnoticed, invisible. And Gardula is a very cruel being indeed. But some things are universal. Obi-Wan Kenobi has a self-sacrificing streak. Better him than someone else, he says to Shmi, and later to Annie, as they cover his bleeding back with poultice and feed him sips of Tzai. Ben has secret meetings with those of Gardula's slaves who are in a position to know what she's doing, thinking, and planning. Mainly Gardula's majordomo, himself, and the dancers, who most freeborn seem to think either deaf or too stupid to realize what they hear, because they never watch what they say in front of them. Together, they piece together what each knows, and from that, they have a very good idea of the entirety of Gardula's operations. This information gets put to good, but careful, use. Gardula gives him an ostentatious collar, because it suits her for everyone to know that she has slaves to do everything for her, including running her crime syndicate. It serves both as an indication of how rich and powerful she is, that she can afford slaves who will do that for her, and as a subtle insult to her trading partners, that she would send a slave to treat with them. He keeps his crisp Coruscanti accent in public. It sends a signal to the crime lords he treats with that he is someone to take seriously, despite his youth. It sends the signal that Gardula is powerful, that she can afford to keep a core-bred slave. In private, when he is among other slaves, his accent flattens, and his vocabulary is peppered with words in Amataka. When Gardula puts up Shmi and 4-year-old Anakin in a bet against the Toydarian Watto, she does not put up Ben. He is indispensable to her operations. But she is not unreasonable, she says. She will allow him to live in Mos Espa's slave quarters with his mother and brother if he wants to. This is a trap. Gardula is his Dapur, his master. She owns him, and she wants him to know it into his very soul. If he says yes, if he takes this tiny piece of freedom that she is offering, she will make him pay. He knows this. She will give him the hardest, most tiring tasks, and work him from before dawn and well into the night. She will not contribute anything to his upkeep, making the family survive on whatever Watto sees fit to give his slaves, and whatever they can scrape together by other means. She will take the price from the very skin on his back. He says yes. She makes him pay. It's worth it. You have heard this story before. The blockade of a peaceful planet, a mission to plead its case in the Senate, a crash landing on a desert planet. A young slave meets an angel, who is secretly a queen, and proclaims his personhood. Even in this story, Anakin Skywalker invites the stranded strangers into his home so they are not stuck in a sandstorm. Anakin's problem was never a lack of heart. Qui-Gon Jinn does not take another apprentice. He holds himself to blame for the disappearance and presumed death of Obi-Wan Kenobi, proving his belief that he destroys the life of any youngling he touches. Both his Padawans are dead, even though Obi-Wan was never his Padawan, but if only. He takes faraway missions that keep him away from the temple for long stretches of time, much like his own master before him. Annie is full of admiration for the Jedi. He believes, despite what Ben says, that the Jedi Knights will come and free the slaves and kill the Hutts. But Qui-Gon Jinn says that they have not come to free the slaves, and disappointment flitters over Annie's face. This Annie is ready to believe it. Doesn't cling to childish fantasies of heroes from outer space who will rescue them all and kill the Hutts. I knew I should have listened to Ben, he says. He says you have lots of rules that prevent you from helping people when they need it. But that's okay, because Ben and I have a plan of our own. Shmi shushes him. Some things must never be spoken of in front of strangers, no matter how trustworthy they seem. Many things in the galaxy are not what they seem, after all. And who is Ben? Asks Qui-Gon. My oldest son, Shmi answers. Gardula kindly and graciously allows him to stay here with us. There is very little kind and gracious about it, but she doesn't say that. She has a feeling that Jedi Master Jin understands. Ben knows everything and can do everything, Annie enthuses. The conversation devolves into the amazingness of Ben Skywalker. Annie doesn't have a chance to offer to race for the Offworlders. Ben returns just as the storm dies down outside. He shakes sand from his shift in the antechamber. Annie's face lights up. Ben! He says, and runs over to give him a hug. Ben ruffles his hair fondly. Did you come all the way from Gardula's in this storm?
It's almost died down, says Ben, as he squeezes Annie tight and bends down to kiss the top of his head.
In the Jedi creche, this would not be allowed. Not with a child nearing 10 years. But Ben will never tell Annie that he is too old for gestures of affection, and will cherish any and all of them for as long as Annie is still willing to bestow and accept them. And goes over to kiss Shmi on the cheek. I thought it was worth the risk to come home to you.
His actions are on autopilot, and he doesn't notice the guests at the table.
Qui-Gon takes a moment to study the young man who has just stepped through the door.
He doesn't recognize Ben.
Why would he? It's been 13 years since he last saw the boy. There's a great difference between 12 and 25. Especially when those 13 years have planted premature lines in his face, making him look much older than he actually is. Especially with the scraggly beard growing on Ben's face. Especially when the harsh light of the twin suns have bleached his hair from a dark auburn into a light strawberry blonde. Why would Qui-Gon's thoughts go to a young initiate he spoke with a few times before the boy disappeared? He believes Obi-Wan Kenobi is dead. He is not entirely wrong.
Ben, say hello to our guests, Shmi says, as her son embraces her. For the first time, Ben turns around and sees the Jedi, the young woman, and the Gungan at the kitchen table. His face takes on the customary blankness he uses when dealing with Gardula or her people, and Shmi tenses. It is only because she knows him so well, can read every little tick in his face, that she sees his surprise, dismay, and fear before it is gone. Ben has more or less come to terms with what was done to him as a child, but the scars are still there. She should have prepared him better, but how could she, with the Jedi in the room hearing every word she says? Ben is used to dealing with things sprung on him. All slaves need to learn how to be adaptable. And she wishes he wasn't, that he didn't keep such a tight lid on his emotions. This isn't just from his years as a slave. Even when she first met him as a child, her oldest son kept his cards close to his chest, guarding every emotion fiercely, as if expecting her to scold him and think less of him. And she is both grateful to the Jedi that they taught him so well, that they made his first few weeks of slavery much more painless than they could have been, and at the same time hating them for twisting even a free-born child who should have no cause to fear opening himself to the world. But slave children aren't the only ones who can be treated very badly indeed. And it makes it far worse that he is only just starting to realize that his childhood in the Jedi Order was not as idyllic as he makes himself believe. "A pleasure," he says, voice smooth, but with the drawl of the Tatooine slaves rather than his crisp core accent. "Are you hungry?" Shmi asks. "No, I ate at Gardula's before she dismissed me," Ben says. "Liar," Shmi says fondly. Ben sits down next to the queen's handmaiden and accepts the bowl Shmi puts in front of him. He eats it with a vigor that tells her that he has not, in fact, eaten at Gardula's, as he claimed. This is not the first or the last time he does this, and she quells a sigh. Her oldest son is far too self-sacrificing. Their food is in short supply, but not so short that he has to starve himself for their sake. But still, the stubborn boy persists. The conversation turns to the off-worlder's situation, and Ben looks thoughtful. "I could perhaps change your Republic credits to Wupipi. I have access to Gardula's stores and her books." Shmi looks horrified. "You can't! If they catch you..." She trails off. "The Sarlacc pit is the best they can hope for if he's caught stealing from the huts. But she doesn't want to say that in front of Annie or the Offworlders." Ben understands anyway. "I'll be careful. It will take some time, but it can be done, and they won't notice me." "We don't have time," Padme says. "The people of Naboo are dying now." "I can't do it quickly," Ben says. "Not without getting caught." "Which is not an option," Shmi adds, in case any of the off-worlders think it might be. And that is, of course, when Anakin suggests racing for the money. Both her boys have more generosity than sense. Ben is on her side in the ensuing argument and tells Annie to forget it, but immediately negates that by saying that he will race instead. After all, he also has the reflexes that will allow him to survive, and he is older. Which leads Annie to object that Ben is by far the worst pilot and has no chance. And anyway, Gardula will never let him. Whereas Watto might let Anakin race for a share of the profit should he win. Ben and Shmi hate it, but Annie is right. And it is the only way. Ben excuses himself early, claiming to be tired. The truth is, he doesn't know how to deal with Qui-Gon Jinn, who in another life might have been his teacher, mentor, and parent figure. He can't help but to compare Qui-Gon to Shmi, and find him intensely lacking. He has never once doubted that Shmi loves him intensely, at her own expense, prepared to sacrifice everything for her boys no matter what, compared to Qui-Gon, who once laid Obi-Wan's every fault out for him, who cut a 12-year-old down so cruelly it is still one of the worst scars Ben carries. And he is a personal slave to one of the galaxy's cruelest beings. "Are we going to meditate before bed?" Annie demands. And Ben wishes he hadn't. At least he knows to never, ever, ever mention sparring to anyone who isn't Shmi or Ben. Ever. This is a matter of life and death, Annie. Do you understand? Annie understands. Annie understands all too well. He doesn't want to give away anything that can connect him to who he was. For a second, when he first saw Qui-Gon, he had a vision of how he'd reveal himself to Qui-Gon, who in his remorse over rejecting Obi-Wan would take Ben on as his Padawan and take him back to the Jedi Order in triumph. But then reality came crashing in. There was no chance they'd accept a Padawan of Ben's age. He'd always be an outsider in the Jedi Order. The one who'd failed as a 12-year-old and was taken back out of pity. And they might accept Annie, but there was no way he could bring Shmi, or Jira, or Kitster, or any of the other slaves in Mos Espa. And Ben is very firmly attached to his family. For years, he dreamed that the Jedi would come and find him on Tatooine. And now that it's finally happened, he finds that he doesn't want to leave. He doesn't want to rejoin the Order. Not if it means leaving Shmi and Annie behind. Not if it means that another of Gardula's slaves, one of his friends or extended family, will have to take his place. He's grown attached. He's lived half his life away from the Jedi Order, and the distance has given him an understanding of how the dispassionate way the Jedi raise their younglings results in some severely messed up individuals. Slavery also results in some severely messed up individuals, but they are different messed up. Ben has managed to get the best of both, and is severely messed up in ways he can't even start to name. And he doesn't know how to deal with the fact that the Jedi is Qui-Gon Jinn, who is indirectly to blame for his current situation. Part of it is also spite. He wants Qui-Gon to recognize him on his own, and be forced to face what happened to the Padawan he rejected. Part of it is that he would very much not like to think about this, thank you very much, and would appreciate if the Jedi could just go away so he doesn't have to deal with his feelings. But Annie comes first, and he leads his brother in their nightly meditation. He can only guess what Qui-Gon feels from their little bedroom. Qui-Gon Jinn wakes in the night to find that Ben and Shmi are talking to each other in hushed voices. He can't hear what they're saying, but it doesn't sound like any language he knows. His mind is worrying. There is no doubt that the brothers are Force-sensitive, yet the mother does not seem to be. Have they inherited it from their father? Do they even have the same one? There is a large age gap between Ben and Anakin. Nobody has made any mention of anyone who could be their father. And what is he to do about their Force sensitivity? He doubts they will be welcome at the Jedi Temple. Ben certainly is too old, a man grown. And even Anakin is technically too old, no matter how strong in the Force he may be. But he cannot leave them in this Force-forsaken place. Not if they have the strength in the Force he thinks they have. The conversation Qui-Gon hears but doesn't understand is Ben and Shmi confronting Ben's past with the Jedi, and Qui-Gon Jinn in particular. They discuss whether to encourage or discourage his interest in Annie, whether life as a Jedi will be better for Annie than life as a slave. Shmi is convinced that freedom will be better. Ben is doubtful. The Jedi will take most of what makes Annie himself and twist it. They will demand that he lets go of his attachment to Ben and Shmi. How is this different, Shmi asks, from the slave creed of not looking back? Letting go of his attachments, Ben says, will mean forgetting that he is Amavikan, a child of Aramu, letting go of where he comes from. Jedi take children early, so they never have the chance to form such a community identity, nor so it is easy for it to be overtaken by their Jedi identity. But Annie is older, and has already formed a strong cultural identity. They won't allow him to be both a former slave from Tatooine and a Jedi, and will insist he forget his old life. Is that a price freedom is worth paying? Shmi says nothing. Her mind says yes, but her heart is unsure. Qui-Gon keeps Jedi habits, even in the field, and rises early. He is not the first one up. Ben serves him breakfast, but he is not offered Sai. Sai is for close friends and family, and Qui-Gon Jinn, in this story, is neither.
You and your brother seem close,
Qui-Gon says to break the silence.
He seems like a very special boy.
He's a handful, is what he is, says Ben with a fond smile. He feels things very deeply, especially injustice, which makes him stubborn. He's passionate and impulsive, and both Mom and I are convinced he'll do something reckless that'll get him into deep trouble one day. But you're right, we are very close. I love him with all my heart, and he loves me just as much.
If Ben had planned a speech to make Anakin seem like an unlikely Jedi candidate, he couldn't have tried better. Which is, of course, the point. He even exaggerates slightly. Annie is normally quite controlled. He has to be to have survived this long. Ben just doesn't know how long it will last. Passion, recklessness, impulsivity, and attachment, and a hint that he might have a temper. All things the Jedi tried to train out of their initiates well before the age of 9. Which is, of course, exactly the point that Ben is trying to make. He can see Qui-Gon's interest in Annie, and he has enough memories of the Jedi crash to know how badly Annie will fit in. The Jedi are not kind to those who do not fit into their narrow mold.
I can imagine how much that must worry you, Qui-Gon says, sympathetic.
Ben says nothing.
Of course Qui-Gon can't imagine how much Annie worries them. He has no idea how much it worries them, or he wouldn't be able to keep his friendly, sympathetic smile up. The fear Shmi and Ben feel for Annie is crippling.
Do you meditate every night?
And now they are on very dangerous ground.
More immediately dangerous than the specter of Annie's eventual outburst, although when that day comes, it will be the worst of Ben's life.
We do. I have read that it helps with a calm and clear mind. So far, I don't know if it's having much effect.
Every word true. But nothing that will lead Qui-Gon to Ben's past, he hopes.
It is unusual for a slave to know how to read and write.
It is, Ben says, ignoring the obvious question in Qui-Gon's comment.
Anakin says you know everything and can do everything, but I suspect that might be the admiration of a younger brother for his older brother.
He exaggerates, and lets his imagination run away with him, like all children are wont to do. Ben says, to further make the point. By the age of 9, this will also have been mostly trained out of the Jedi Padawans.
There are many things I have no skill in at all. Please excuse me, I must go to my master.
Also not a lie.
Qui-Gon watches him leave.
Qui-Gon asks Shmi about the boy's father.
Fathers? And is shut down. Or maybe he is not shut down.
Children born of the Force. How intriguing. He misses that she refers only to Anakin, not Ben.
Qui-Gon is very good at hearing what he wants to hear. He can feel how strong they are, especially last night when they were meditating.
Untrained, of course, leaking everywhere, the younger more than the older.
But that can be taught.
He's glad he has taken no Padawan since the fall of Xanatos.
It must have been the will of the Force that he be free to take on these two boys to teach them.
He makes a bargain with the Toydarian, betting the ship against the parts required to fix it. It is no great loss. Without the parts, the ship is useless. One does not gain anything if one is not also willing to lose it. He takes a blood test in the night, claiming it to be for inoculations. He has nobody at the ship who can run it, so he keeps it until they can get back. He has suspicions about the boy, but no way to confirm them. And, unfortunately, he can't find a good excuse to test the older brother. He imagines those results would also be very interesting. Annie is sent off to bed before Ben returns. He makes some complaints, but is docile enough that Qui-Gon understands this to be a fairly regular occurrence. He is pleased to see that the boy is disciplined enough to do his meditations anyway. Ben returns late at night, tired into his bones and hungry. Padme and Jar Jar have gone to bed, only Shmi and Qui-Gon are still up. Shmi is repairing something electronic for Watto's shop. Annie is not the only mechanic in the family. Qui-Gon is deep in thought that is interrupted by the arrival of Shmi's older, Force-sensitive son. He has made some discreet inquiries about the boys, and been rebuffed by Shmi, who doesn't find his inquiries at all discreet. But even if he were to take them to Coruscant, to the Jedi Temple, the question still remains, how is he to get them off Tatooine? The younger boy, he can see, he'd make a bet with the boy's owner, perhaps get the mother as well if he's lucky. Although that will pose new complications, finding a place for the mother where she'll be safe, at the same time severing the boy's attachment to her. The mother is not a priority. But the older, he knows of the huts, and he knows that to get one slave from the huts, there is a good chance he would doom Naboo in the process. He's not sure if it's worth it. He's not sure what it says about him, that he still considers it. Ben takes one look at the room and sits down in front of Qui-Gon with his bowl. Obi-Wan Kenobi was always good at reading a room. Ben Skywalker has only become better at it since it became so crucial to his very survival. "You believe Annie can be a Jedi?" he opens. No room for misunderstandings, for coded things left unsaid. This is to be a conversation with all the cards on the table, except for the ones he guards close to his heart, the ones that slaves know are not spoken of with those who are free, the ones nobody but he and Shmi know. "I believe he is a very special boy," Qui-Gon hedges. Ben says nothing. "Yes, I believe he can be a Jedi," he admits. "I can offer him a good life as a free person. He clearly looks up to the Jedi. I'm sure he would enjoy the chance." Shmi says nothing, but she looks up from her circuits to show that she is listening and aware of the conversation. This is between her son and the man who abandoned him 13 years ago. But she will be there for him if he needs her. "He enjoys many things that are not good for him," Ben says dryly. "He's lived his entire life as a slave. What'll happen when he's too old, too scared, too angry to be trained? He'll be all alone, cut off from his family with nowhere to go." "We will look after him. The Jedi do not abandon our younglings." "The Jedi do not abandon their younglings. Except when they do." Ben takes a deep breath to calm himself down. The irony of Qui-Gon Jinn, of all people, telling that to the very boy he abandoned makes Ben want to either laugh or break something. He's not sure which. "I have no way to stop you if you decide claiming Annie for the Jedi is best. You could go to Watto, buy him or steal him or whatever it is you plan,
and Annie, Mom, and I would be powerless against you. But if you do, I do have one request I would like to make. We slaves have the same mourning rights when someone is sold to new and distant owners as when they die. Would you please allow him to mourn us before you demand he lets go of his attachment? But of course. Thank you for letting me know. Qui-Gon doesn't know how deeply the Amavi can guard their secrets. He doesn't realize what a rare and precious gift he is given to be offered an insight into Amavikan culture. Even if he did, he might not treasure it as it is meant to be treasured. You seem quite knowledgeable about Jedi customs, he probes. I wasn't born on Tatooine, says Ben shortly. But that's a very long story. It's late, and I have to be up early tomorrow. Qui-Gon takes the hint. In later years, when he finds out the truth about Ben, he will curse himself for not probing further. But everything in this moment tells him that the other man will not be open to it. He changes the subject. Is there anything I can do to help you? He asks. This family has done so much for him. It would be wrong not to thank them in some ways. I can leave you some Republic credits for you to change to Wapipi and buy your freedom. That's kind, but I'm afraid it's too risky. If I'm caught, it will definitely mean my death, and quite likely my mom's and Annie's as well. But thank you for the thought. You would take that risk for us, but not for yourself? Qui-Gon asks, astonished. Why? Because it's the right thing to do. Because the people of Naboo are dying. Because Mom always says that the biggest problem in the universe is that nobody helps each other, Ben says. He doesn't say, because you abandoned me to slavery, and I will not give in to my anger over that. Because I'm better than that. Because revenge is not the Jedi way. Ben Skywalker is not a Jedi, but Obi-Wan Kenobi might have been once, and that matters. Then I'm honored. You show great bravery and kindness. Is there any way I can help you? Anakin says you and he have a plan of your own. He's working on a scanner for your explosives, I believe. Ben nods, but he frowns. He shouldn't have said that. I assure you I'm trustworthy. I won't tell a soul. It's not a matter of whether we can trust you. Except it is. But you're an outsider. You have to understand, as slaves, we have to be very careful with what we say to outsiders. There is little response Qui-Gon can make to that, so he makes none. Ben finishes his meal. Well, I'm off to bed. Good night, Mom. Good night, Master Jin. In another story, Obi-Wan Kenobi calls Qui-Gon Jinn Master as a mark of respect and admiration. Ben Skywalker says it, and means something different.